Your dial is set to KRWG-FM, Las Cruces, New Mexico, celebrating 10 years of service to Southern New Mexico. It was 10 years ago today, Saturday, October 3rd, 1964, that KRWG-FM went on the air, the voice of New Mexico State University. Tonight, KRWG presents a 10th anniversary broadcast saluting our station, the people who operate it, the Department of Journalism, our programs, and our listeners. Presenting a 2.5-hour tribute to oneself is not only showing one's conceit, but if you're a radio station, the project is also very difficult. 10 years is a lot of broadcast airtime. Just what do you pick to spotlight? Well, on tonight's program, we won't give you a moment to get bored. In quick glimpses, we'll fly through the years, meeting just a few of the people who have made KRWG-FM work, and listen to some of the very best moments of broadcasting. We are generally a happy and fun-loving radio station, so we hope to keep you smiling a lot also. The program will probably be the most fun for those of you who have been regular listeners for a lengthy period of time. But for you new KRWG fans, this might explain a lot of questions you may have had about the craziest radio station you've ever heard.
What is KRWG-FM? That question is as complex as the philosophical questions, what is life? What is reality? What is man? What is time? And so on. It cannot be defined very easily or in a short period of time. First of all, we can say that it is a radio station, but after that, it is different things to different people. Throughout tonight's broadcast, we will be trying to define KRWG-FM. We will not accomplish the task, but maybe we will give you some insight into how this unique station functions. Shall we begin down that path to find out what KRWG-FM is?
This educational radio station has spent 10 years of trying to please everyone, at least some of the time. Its purpose was to educate, not in the strict, hard-nosed classroom style, but in the way that every day of life brings more knowledge to all humans. We have done it through news programs as well as college lectures, through music programs as well as through satirical comedy shows, or through dramatic presentations as well as through programs about foreign countries. New Mexico State University is varied in its purposes and contributions to the community, but basically, it provides training to young people in specific fields, and it provides educational experiences for the community. KRWG-FM reflects this also. The station is a laboratory for the Department of Journalism's broadcast option, and this lab provides fine arts programming for the Las Cruces area. The station was set up to give Las Cruces area radio listeners an opportunity to hear music and public affairs programming not available on the local commercial stations. The creation of KRWG can generally be attributed to one man. His name was Harvey C. Jacobs. From 1964 to February of this year, he was the head of the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications here at New Mexico State University. He was a giant of a man, not in his size, but in what he was able to accomplish. There was no department here when he came from Indiana. He started one. The radio station that was on campus had been shut down by a vote by the student body for its inconsistency in broadcasting and poor programming. Harvey Jacobs took that closed-circuit station under the Department of Journalism as a radio laboratory and applied to the Federal Communications Commission to begin a new FM stereo educational radio station. To get equipment for the station, Harvey personally drove a truck all over the country, picking up surplus radio gear. The station was built in an old army barracks and went on the air with just a handful of dedicated students and faculty members. The station began with only 740 watts of power, but Harvey persisted, and the FCC granted next 1,000 watts, then 3,500 watts, and finally the maximum of any FM radio station in the United States, 100,000 watts. His department grew in all areas, but his greatest achievement was the building of a new 1.7 million watt educational TV station with full color facilities that was also operated by students of NMSU. As you will hear in interviews with some of Harvey Jacobs' friends and colleagues, the powers that were said it couldn't be done. Harvey proved it could be done, and his greatest accomplishment was getting those who held the purse strings to go along with his idea and to see for themselves that students directed by professional staffs could turn out a professional product that rivaled the commercial radio and television stations. We really wish that Harvey Jacobs could be with us tonight for our 10th anniversary, but earlier this year he returned to his home in Indiana to take over the editorship of the Indianapolis News. His heart and hopes are still with us, and he complained bitterly with us on the phone last week about educational broadcasting in the Indianapolis area. He is with us tonight by way of tape recording.
Greetings to all of my friends in the New Mexico Southwest. This is Harvey Jacobs speaking to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, where I am now engaged in the editorship of the Indianapolis News. But although I'm pretty well rooted in this, my home state, I left quite a generous portion of myself there at New Mexico State University. It is a real pleasure to greet you on the 10th anniversary of KRWG. As most of you know, I feel as though a good deal of my limited talent and energy went into the establishment of this radio station. And no matter how far I may stray from New Mexico State, the warmest spot in my heart will always be reserved for KRWG radio. As they say, those who reminisce, it seems only yesterday that I was tramping about the campus with Fred Day and others searching out a place to put a new radio station. This was regarded as one of our top priorities, inasmuch as the broadcasters of New Mexico felt that the university should have laboratory facilities for those who were studying broadcasting. And it certainly was logical that we have this kind of curriculum and laboratory, inasmuch as Dean Ralph W. Goddard was one of the early pioneers in the Southwest, having founded KOB on that campus in 1922. Incidentally, as we were tramping about the campus looking for a site for our new radio station, Fred Day took me into the pigeon-infested attics of Goddard Hall and several other such places. It seemed that it would be so logical to have the new station in the building that bore Dean Goddard's name, but there just wasn't enough space, and it certainly was not adequate. So, as university administrators are wont to do, or were wont to do in earlier days at least, they turned with a sigh of resignation and said, well, it looks as though it would have to be a Army barracks for your headquarters. I shuddered and wondered if this was why I'd come all the way from Chicago to the Southwest to start a department and a radio station and the accompanying laboratories in a World War II Army barracks. But, you know, it turned into a pretty good facility. Oh, of course, the halls were narrow and the floors creaked and groaned. making it very easy for us to hear the stylus jumping across the records. If anyone larger than 100 pounds walked across the floor. But all in all, it was a functional place to begin. And as I said in the beginning, it seems only yesterday that I was carrying records from my house to the control room, trying to provide enough musical fare for the infant radio station. Those were certainly difficult and improvising days. Even on the first day, 10 years ago, we were improvising, scrambling and scurrying for additional equipment. We had accumulated all of these greetings on various pieces of tape from over the state, the governor and the president of the university and other assorted celebrities. And it seems that the engineering staff and the student manager who was going to inaugurate this first broadcast had forgotten that all of these tapes had not been edited together and that we were faced with a real emergency in making changing tapes within a matter of seconds. Even those of you who are not familiar with the techniques of broadcasting know that this is almost impossible. And we were starting on the air, it seems, with only one tape recorder. And we were actually already broadcasting when it suddenly dawned upon the person on the air and the engineer that we needed another tape recorder desperately. And I don't know where it was conjured up from, but Jack Selmayr rushed into another room and brought back a tape recorder and quickly wired it into the circuits so that we were able to do most of the things that we'd set out to do on that first day. I said the keynote was improvising, and it certainly was. We had no special program service. We just used what we had available. And we also had to take about whomever decided they wanted to work on the station, whether they were well prepared or not. During holidays, for example, we prevailed upon some of the students to stay over and not let the station go off the air because we felt that we had a good chance for lots of new listeners on those holiday periods. And I remember several occasions carrying the Christmas dinner and the New Year's Day dinner to the on-the-air person so that he could enjoy a little bit of the holiday spirit, even though he sat before the control board. Yes, I left a good deal of myself in the Southwest and a lot of me in that radio station. But any celebration of this type certainly needs to acknowledge some other fine folks. And I guess I'd want to begin with the program director, John Athey, who arrived upon the scene fairly early in the life of KRWG, was its student program director, and then left to get an advanced degree and came back to work at this job full time. And there's Harold Service, who has done a remarkable job in managing this station and keeping it on an even keel. Harold is calm and businesslike and manages the operation with much skill. And again, there was another essential hand, two hands, in fact, two of the most skilled hands that I've ever known, Jim Doran, who's still there on the scene keeping this broadcast operation together from the technical point of view. Jim wasn't in the control room, as I remember, on the first day, but he was certainly hovering in the shadows while Jack Selmayr was frantically getting us on the air. But it wasn't long before Jim was there. And certainly the three-man team that is there handling most of the operations on KRWG, John, Harold, and Jim, have certainly done a great job. When we started KRWG, there was only 1 hour of classical music coming into the valley. That was from El Paso. There were no stereo stations. And it was our good fortune to be on the scene to reap the harvest of that kind of situation, where I think thousands of people were eager to have an alternative radio service brought to them by their university. I now live in the metropolitan center, the 11th largest city in the United States, and there is no public radio service that can even start to match the programming and the technical quality and the general service of KRWG-FM. I've traveled a good deal in these United States, and I am brash enough to assess the situation in this way. I doubt if there are more than a half dozen communities in the United States that are better served by public radio than Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I'm pretty sure that I can make another statement that cannot be challenged, that there is not another laboratory operation in the United States in connection with the university that can match the broadcast laboratories on the New Mexico State University campus. I feel a good deal of pride in having had a small part in the development of those laboratories, and I feel good about their future. And I send my warmest greetings to all of you, both personnel and listeners, for continued success. And I trust that in another 10 years, we may have this same kind of chat and feel gratified that this broadcasting arm of the university has rendered 20 years of distinguished service.
How did it happen that this talented man found his way to New Mexico? That question was answered in an interview with former NMSU President Roger B. Corbett.
I had gotten to know Mr. D.D. Monroe of Clayton. Mr. Monroe is still living, and I think he's still running an abstract company there. But Mr. Monroe was a very active man in Rotary. He'd been on some of the international committees, and he called me one day from Clayton. He had been, by the way, on the campus here to speak several times and knew the school and knew some of us here at the school. And he said, I've worked for 5 or 6 years with Harvey Jacobs, who was the second man in the organization that runs International Rotary. And by that I mean the people who were employed, who had jobs to operate it. And he said, he's one of the most able men I have ever known. And he's got to leave the Chicago area because of the climate there, and his family are not thriving at all, and he must leave. And then he said, you've just got to have this man. He's so able. Well, I said, I'm going to be in Chicago in a couple of weeks. You give me his name and address, I'll get in touch with him, and we'll see if we can't get together. So I wrote to Harvey. And he met Bill O'Donnell and me. We were up there for a North Central meeting. I think we were talking about our PhD program, which was just well underway at that time. And Harvey met us at O'Hare Airfield. We went down to Palmer House and had dinner together. And I must say, I've been a strong supporter of Harvey ever since. We had no job open. Our budgets were fixed except one. Unfortunately, from the point of view of the alumni work, the man who was an alumnus of the school had just recently taken this over. He lived in Buffalo, had moved here. He returned to Buffalo, and in that visit, he died of a heart attack. And this left the job of alumni director open. It wasn't very good pay in those days. But that's the only thing I had, and Harvey said, well, I've been working with alumni on one or two occasions and know something about it, and I'll take the job. With the understanding that he would become head of the journalism and mass communications, as it was later named, when the year was up. So he did. He came down and took for the first few months, he was director of alumni relations until we got him into journalism and mass communications. And of course, I know how aggressive he was, and he was doing just the job that I felt needed to be done for New Mexico State University.
This is Marilyn Hendricks presenting a brief history of radio on the New Mexico State University campus. In June of 1920, the first radio station west of the Mississippi River was founded on the small southwestern campus of New Mexico College of Agriculture and Mechanical Arts in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Under the direction of Ralph W. Goddard, Dean of the College of Engineering, the station was installed at the engineering department in its studies. Dean Goddard's major field was electrical engineering, which explains why he was so interested and devoted to the station and its equipment. Dean Goddard and the students who worked with him started from scratch to yield one of the finest radio stations of its time. In the early days of the station, Dean Goddard provided for himself as far as the station was concerned. He begged and borrowed the materials he needed to build a small building, furnished mostly with the crude equipment he and the engineering students had made themselves. The original call letters of that station were KOB. KOB received its commercial license April 5, 1922, after 2 years of regular daily broadcasting from the shack built by Dean Goddard. Soon after acquiring a license, KOB expanded from just daily time signals and weather forecast to phonograph music 3 times each week. If you can picture an Aggie football game back in 1922, then you can also see Dean Goddard sitting in the stands broadcasting the first live Aggie game over the air. On October 14th, while the Aggies were romping on the field, Dean Goddard was again adding another first to his list of records by transmitting live from the stadium with a portable telephone set. Dean Goddard worked diligently through the next 7 years to make KOB one of the largest and best stations of its kind in the nation. On April 18, 1924, the first live music was presented by the Aggie Band. From that time on, KOB utilized its equipment for frequent live broadcast. Faculty members and local guests often spoke on the programs. The Highway Department gave its cooperation to KOB and furnished the station with road condition reports. The Extension Service at the college broadcast agricultural information to the listeners of the Mesilla Valley. By 1926, KOB had hired a studio orchestra which presented concerts every Friday night. KOB continued to grow in quality and power, and in 1927 it was recognized as the most powerful college station in the world. At that time, it could be received over a 700-mile radius. Dean Goddard had built this pioneer radio into one of the largest stations of any type, but it would soon be forgotten on the campus of New Mexico A&M. The year 1928 meant a great deal to KOB. In January, KOB was given a temporary reassignment and received later in the year a clear channel 1180 kilocycle frequency. Also in that year, on New Year's Eve, Dean Goddard died in the KOB station he had constructed. He was accidentally electrocuted by some of the equipment in the transmitter room while making last-minute preparations for a special program scheduled to be aired that night. Harold Elmendorf and his wife, Sarah, of Las Cruces, were friends of Dean and Mrs. Goddard. On that New Year's Eve night, they and other friends were expecting to have dinner and play bridge later with the Dean and his wife. Would you please tell us about that night?
Well, that night was a pretty horrible experience. Mr. Goddard had sent word that he would be a little late, and they could go ahead and have the dinner, which we were supposed to be. And we waited for some time, and still no results. And finally, somebody either went from the party to see what was keeping him, or somebody from the college told, I don't know just which it was. But anyway, at that time, we found that he had been found laying on the floor right below some big switches, electrical switches, which he had evidently been working with for some reason. And he was then just dead on the floor. And of course, in the latter part, he was dean of engineering. But all through there, he did his work and kept up with everything that he was supposed to do. And then all his spare time, he put on this hobby, which eventually became a KOB station. It was more or less of his hobby, and he spent all of his spare time and all the spare money, too, because the college never put any money into it, as far as I know. And he worked it out with some of the boys, a little shack back of the engineering building, which is Goddard Hall, you know, it was the engineering building then. And he spent all his spare time, and whenever he could get a little money together to be able to get a new piece of equipment and make and improve something, he was just fooling with it all the time. It was his the biggest thing in his life, practically. And one of the things the people that you ask about didn't pay much attention to him, very few, if any. And it was just a hobby, and if he wanted to do it, well, it's fun, but it didn't mean anything. But sometime before he died, it developed into a pretty good station, rather local, and worked on agricultural reports and things like that, which they gave through the air. And before he died, it was known, and I can't remember how it came out, but it was noted that this was the first and only college-endorsed radio station west of the Mississippi River. We used to hear that. There wasn't anything else here.
Zelmendorf, have you ever heard how he financed the station?
Well, mostly by just... he had a little bit of money that was given to him by the engineering department, and then he went around and found odds and ends of things and made a great deal of his own equipment. And he had a number of students who were just as interested as he was, and they were quite willing to put in their spare time helping him both with the shack and then with the equipment, which came later on. And as far as we knew at the time, there was only one boy who was working his way through college who did receive 25 cents an hour for helping Dean Goddard at the time that any spare time that he had. And most of it was just what he could scrounge around and find on the campus that somebody else wasn't using that he could utilize for his own job.
Mrs. Elmendorf, you said that one time you were an honored guest at one of the broadcasts. Could you tell us more about it?
Well, it was just one of the very first ones that he had, and there was something coming in over the air that he thought that those of us that belonged to their bridge club would enjoy more at the station than we would over the radios in our own homes. And so we all went up, and it happened to be a rather bad night as far as static was concerned. And all we seemed to get was a very shrill voice, lady singing, and more static than singing, and Dean Goddard was kept busy running from here to there to someplace else, trying to turn buttons on or off to bring it in a little bit better, and it didn't come in any better. In fact, it got worse until he finally just was a little bit embarrassed and gave up and decided that there wouldn't be any concert that night. We'd have to come back at a later date.
With the death of Dean Goddard, the life of KOB dwindled. Mr. Elmendorf said that no one really took him seriously, which was confirmed when the station lost the will to survive after the death of its founder and overseer.
After his death, such a shock that nobody was very much interested in it in the first place, and no one had any interest, to the degree that the dean did. And so when he wasn't there, the whole thing kind of sloughed off. And not after a short time, why, nobody was doing anything with the station. And this group, small group that was starting a radio station in Albuquerque, offered, I don't know the amount of money, but it was a rather small sum of money. And even that they couldn't pay. And so when they couldn't meet those payments, they offered a good many hours of radio time that could be used by the college until they said, and the whole thing was rather a song, you might say, for the whole thing that they got. License was the main asset that was transferred, and they built it up since, of course, to quite a big plant. But the university didn't get anything out of it, speak of.
New Mexico A&M neglected radio broadcasting from Dean Goddard's death in 1928 until 1952, when the engineering department took over once more the task of finding equipment, building radio station, and giving it a name. The college's name had been changed a short time before to New Mexico State University. The call letters for the new station were to be KNMS, but were again changed to KNMA for the New Mexico Aggies. KNMA continued to operate under the engineering department until 1964, when it was taken over by the Department of Journalism and Mass Communication. In the fall of 1963, the call letters of New Mexico State University-owned radio station were changed again. This time it was in memory of the man who made radio history over 40 years before on the same campus, Ralph Willis Goddard. KRWG was once again making history when in 1964 the FM station was created. It was the first college or university FM station in the state of New Mexico, the third FM station of any type in the state, and one of the first 10 stereo FM educational stations in the country. The AM station kept the call letters KNMA until 1965, when they also were dropped for the more convenient KRWG of the FM station. Once housed in a one-room shack built with scraps of material Dean Goddard could find, then also in the engineering building, then again reestablished in the inadequate facilities of the stadium barracks, KRWG is now in the newly remodeled Milton Hall, the center of the Journalism and Mass Communication Department. Since 1963, KRWG AM and FM have persistently gained in performance and have earned the respect of New Mexico State University and the entire southwestern area of the United States. Today, KRWG is once more one of the largest stations in the nation, boasting a 100,000-watt FM stereo multiplex system which reaches an estimated 1 million people in New Mexico, in surrounding states, and in Mexico.
To update the history of KRWG AM since the preceding report was made, the closed-circuit carrier current student station was moved out of Milton Hall in May of this year to a new location across the street in Corbett Center. On September 20th, the station changed its call letters to KNMS.
Most of our older listeners delight in telling the younger generation why I'll never forget the day the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Why, it's almost as popular a subject as Granddad's account of how he collected all those scars. Or what were you doing the day President Kennedy was assassinated? Every time a major story breaks, KRWG-FM and the announcers take on a mood, one of excitement or mournfulness. KRWG is equipped with a net alert box, that is, a small metal box with a speaker in it. The box monitors ABC radio 24 hours a day, and only when ABC sounds the bulletin tone does the speaker come on. The tone is loud and high-pitched and can be heard rooms away. The sound of it by itself is enough to give the board announcer goose pimples, not even knowing what the bulletin is. The man on the board is to listen to ABC immediately and find out what is coming up of importance, and then, if it is a bulletin, kill whatever's on the air and turn on ABC. Bulletins are seldom good news. In ancient times, bearers of bad news were killed, and many times we here at the station would like very much to carry out that tradition by pulling the darn bulletin box off the wall. But during almost every major news story, strange moods prevail around the station, even to the point of making the studio look different. Sadder, darker, lonelier. During our special anniversary program, we will begin with the first major story the station ever covered in 1964, and end with a highlight from today's top news story. You know, in those early years, it was difficult to find just one important story for a single year. The Vietnam story was always there, and the space program was fun to follow. But then in the past 2-3 years, it became necessary to divide major stories by hours, not days or years. There have been times when we felt we were interrupting bulletins for still other bulletins. Well, relive with us the news from the past 10 years, and allow us to ask you, where were you when?
The major supply lines would have to be interdicted where they leave Red China. Either that, or we have a war dragged out and dragged out. A defensive war is never won. Defoliation of the forest by low-yield atomic weapons could well be done. When you remove the foliage, you remove the cover.
Weapons do not make peace. Men make peace. And peace comes not through strength alone, but through wisdom and patience and restraint.
To those of us who make our living feeding the KRWG FM monster, it's like a lovable invalid, something that's nearly alive, but must be helped along constantly. The station is great happiness to us when we perform well on the air and hear nice things from listeners. It's great despair when things go wrong and there seems to be no way to get back on the right track. Social life and days off are but dreams for staff members. Just when we plan an evening, someone calls in sick or gives an Academy Award-winning performance as to why they can't make their air shift, and we end up canceling our evening and taking that shift.
From 1966 to 1968, KRWG's station manager was a young lady from Ohio by the name of Lyndon Fisher. She had just returned from the South Pacific, where she helped establish educational broadcasting in American Samoa. During her second year as manager, she married a journalism major, Robert Raper. Mr. and Mrs. Raper are still living in Las Cruces, and we talked by phone with Lyndon about memories, good and bad, in those early days.
John Brockmuller was on FM, and Tommy Tomlin called me and said he would not be able to make it for some reason or other to get AM open and on the air. So he asked me if I would get up at 5:30 to get or be over at the station by 5:30 a.m. to see that AM got on the air. And I said that would be fine. And so that was all set up, and I went home and went to bed early. Well, something happened to the news teletype around 9 o'clock, and so they called me, and I had just gone to bed, and I got up and got dressed and went over to check on the teletype, and then I went back home and went to bed, and at 1 a.m., when FM was due to go off the air, John Brockmuller discovered that he had locked the transmitter room door and couldn't take FM's transmitter off the air. So he called me at 1:30 a.m., and I went over there and took FM off the air and got up at 5:30 and put AM on the air. And that was the night that I could have lived without.
In November of 1965, New York City was plunged into darkness by the great power blackout.
Starting in New York City at about 5:30 this afternoon, and then spreading through upstate New York, Massachusetts, Canada, and Pennsylvania, 30 million persons found themselves without light, subways, elevators, air conditioners. For almost 3 hours, power officials in New York State have been promising a restoration of power. A few minutes ago, Consolidated Edison said it seems apparent most of New York City will be without power for most of the night.
A few weeks later, El Paso and Las Cruces had an instant replay when the electricity went off for over 2 hours. In the old barracks, there were no windows. An announcer had to stumble around in the dark, around counters of equipment, out into the hallway, through two interlocking doors, and out onto the front porch to discover whether indeed the electricity had gone off, or he was suffering from some kind of sudden blindness. In our studios in Milton Hall, there are outside windows in the hallway, but in no other rooms. If it is daylight when the electricity goes off, everyone can see, faintly. But there is little one can do. The typewriters are all electric, the phones often don't work, the water fountain warms up, the Coke machine is dead, the candy machine jams, and the air conditioning goes off. This station is, needless to say, off the air. But that's to be expected. However, it is frightening to realize how useless one can be without electricity.
And here's Alan Greenwood.
You are tuned to KRWG 90.7 FM, Las Cruces.
There are no 2 days alike. It's a continual race for the clock. It's no days off, not even Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, Easter, or the 4th of July.
KRWG's second program director in the years 1965 and 66 was a giant of a man, weighing in somewhere around 300 pounds, with a voice that rivaled the Queen Mary's foghorn. He usually appeared around the station in his pressed white Navy uniform, since he was the Navy recruiter here in Las Cruces. His name was George Barnhorst, but we affectionately called him Barney. He is in Denver, Colorado now, working at a federal prison power plant. He was kind enough to tape a few words about some old times around the station.
Congratulations. You ask about some of the old days, the olden days, the days when we first started on the air back in 1964. And some of the people we had associated with us at that time. Monty Stanford was our first station manager. And there was another clever young man who worked exceedingly hard to put KRWG-FM on the air and to put it over once it was on the air. Monty worked long hours. He ran to El Paso to pick up parts. He bummed. He begged. He scrounged. He did everything he possibly could to make the station a success. And any success I believe the station has today, we'll have to go back to Monty Stanford, because Stanford really put in the long hours, the hard times. Monty had the ability to get others to do as he wanted without, making people feel that they were being used, shall we say. Monty really worked at it. And when I became associated with the station, the first thing, of course, Monty says, well, now, I'm sure you'll have ideas of how we should do things, and I'll appreciate anything that you can offer. And I thought, well, how nice this is. So that's the way I got into KRWG. And the first air time that I really took over was at Christmas that first year, 1964, when of course, the school closed down and everyone bailed out. And Monty, who had been working long and hard hours and just literally running himself ragged, wanted to go home to visit his parents. So he handed me the key and to the front door down there at the old wooden barracks underneath the bell tower, and says, Barney, you've got it. I says, well, what do you have in mind for the Christmas holidays? Well, we'll come on the air at 6, and we'll sign off at 11 or 12. Some of the best times I had was some air time, of course. My favorite program was the Sunday afternoon opera. I doubt if I had too many listeners. We had a few who were steady. We heard from them every Sunday. But I imagine the average person was like the average student we had there in the department. Opera? Phooey. I could never get anyone to do it for me, so if I was going to have opera on the air on Sunday, I had to do it.
KRWG is synonymous with loneliness during vacations.
During the Watts riots of 1965, tempers flared in the station, but all student announcers managed to work together.
I want no man at any time alone.
Right.
We want security, not horsing around. As we get out of those trucks, I want fixed bayonets as we dismount.
Sirens, fire engines, ambulances, police cars, burglar alarms. Absolutely incredible scene. The gun battle. Rampage of rioting and looting in a small section of the Negro community on the south side of town. This friend small army of policemen, most of them carrying shotguns. National Guardsmen riding jeeps with 30-caliber machine guns. Runs along the edge of Beverly Hills. That's the sound of a high-pressure pumper from the fire department, knocking down a blaze far removed from the main riot scene.
Whenever you get 40 to 100 students working together on a radio station, you're bound to have personality conflicts. We can honestly admit to dozens of arguments around the station blazing every week or so. But the radio station has always been a close-knit group. In some years, closer-knit probably than any social fraternity on campus.